We're in. I was so it was funny. So I was interviewing Seth Godin for the podcast, and I was over at his home office, or not his home office. He has like an office in the town.
Yeah.
And he says to me before we start, goes, "You want any chocolate?" And I go, "Yeah, why not, Seth?" So he takes out this big basket filled mostly with Askenozy chocolate, and he takes a bar out and he breaks off a piece, and he says to me, he goes, "Okay, what you want to do is break off a little piece, put it in your mouth, and let it just hang in your mouth. Don't chew it. Let it just sit there. Taste everything." And as he's saying this to me, I'm completely not listening to him. I take the whole piece, put it in my mouth, start chewing, like, in real time. And I go, "Oh, my God, Seth, I completely did what you told me not to do. I completely blew the whole thing." And he goes, "Okay, here's another piece. Try it again." And we went through this whole thing. How much of a chocolate sommelier can you be? How much depth is there in the chocolate? Because it's funny, on the back of all your packages, it says, "This chocolate has strawberry, blueberry, and honey flavors," or it has all these traces. And when I taste your chocolate, to me it is rich, it is creamy, there's a complex flavor to it, it's absolutely delicious. I don't taste any of those things. What am I doing wrong? Are you getting those scents?
You are doing nothing wrong. I think that's a great question. The depths are, I'm going to take this off. Is it okay if I take
yeah,
it off?
No, yeah, it's totally fine.
Kind of
yeah.
disconcerting. You're not doing anything wrong. What we say on the package is you might taste.
That's true.
Here's what I love about this question. It's one of the reasons that I wanted to go into chocolate. There is no bottom of the pool as to what you can learn and how expert you can be at making chocolate, at tasting the different flavors. And so I think for some people who are super tasters, or maybe two or three steps back from super tasters, they can really discern aroma and flavor that I can't. And so for some people and for most people, what I encourage is just kind of what Seth said, which is just be mindful about it, put it in your mouth, and what do you taste?
Do you feel like you've developed the ability, like if I give you a cold piece of chocolate, or not cold, but a blind piece of chocolate, do you have the ability to say, "Oh, that tastes like a Tanzanian bean," or "That tastes like a Philippine bean," or are you that in depth with it, or is it really tough to get those little differences?
I can tell you with GPS pinpoint accuracy, not only the country, but the farm and the part of the farm. I'm just kidding.
But the thing is, that doesn't sound that crazy to me. No, I think you'd be able to do that.
No, I can't. I can't. And really, I've never been able to do that.
Yeah.
I can tell the difference in countries frequently. But beyond that, it's hard for me, especially if it's not our chocolate, you know. But some of the countries and regions have a very distinctive flavor because of the variety of bean. And like wine, you know, the crop year and its exposure to sun, soil, climate, all of that will make a difference. But no, I'm not a super taster.
So what are the things when you talk about quality control for the chocolate, what are the elements that you're tasting for, or that you're tasting for at the factory? Because I'm assuming that every handful of bars you end up tasting, you say, is this still the level that we need it to be? Yeah. Is it creaminess when it kind of sits in your mouth? Is it the flavor intensity? Like, how do you judge the different levels of it?
The first thing that we do is smell the chocolate, because taste is 90% smell. So if you're going to try to judge the quality of the chocolate, or really any food, if you're really intent on it, would be to first look at it and see if you see characteristics. What we're talking about now is chocolate. And can I see any characteristics in the chocolate bar that would automatically be an error? So has it been tempered properly? And I can tell just by looking at the chocolate, is it proper temper? Is it shiny, glossy? And then I'm going to break it. So I'm using that sense of hearing. And does it sound? Does it make a snap? That's going to tell me if it's a quality piece of chocolate that's been well tempered. And then I'm going to want to kind of put my thumb on it and release some aroma and smell it. And that's going to give me, and when I'm in the field and at origin and I'm tasting cocoa beans, if I roast them over a campfire, I'm going to be able to tell a lot more about the end result by smelling those beans roasting than by actually pulling those beans off the fire and tasting them. So that, to me, is where the quality really begins for us, is visually looking at it, listening, and then, of course, smelling and tasting. And I can get way more detailed than that. But for us, roasting is the first place.
Did you come to that conclusion over trial and error? Like, at first, were you tasting the beans, and then were you realizing that wasn't a great indicator of whether it would create great chocolate? And then you started to realize that, is it like an earthy smell or a vibrant smell? Like, what's the smell that you're chasing with it?
Well, it depends on the origin. So in Ecuador, we're chasing something very specific. That bean variety that we use is called Arriba Nacional, and it is a very earthy, tobacco-y, leathery, and when I say robust, it's kind of, and you said complex, some of the chocolate is complex. And so if you were looking at it on a graph, I mean, it would be all over the place. Lots of spikes, lots of valleys, a lot of changes in flavor. So I'm going to be looking for that, but I can influence that really only in one place after the farmers have done their thing, which is really important for their fermentation and drying of the beans. But that's roasting. And if we don't nail it in the roast for aroma and flavor, then we have no other opportunity. I mean, I can't like add more sugar to make it taste better or add vanilla to make it taste better. I'm going to pull that out in the roasting profile. And so that is trial and error. Roast, 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 roast. You know, we've done this for 18 years.
Right.
And in most of the cases with the farmers that I work with, I've been buying from them from going on 2 decades.
Yeah.
Same people. So... and I take none of that for granted. That's why I travel there all the time. I just got back from the Philippines. I just bought tickets yesterday to go to Tanzania. And when I go to Tanzania in a few weeks, it'll be my 51st origin trip.
Wow.
So, and why? It's because I want to do what I have mentioned. You know, I want to visit with the farmers and not take for granted that they're going to give me the exact same quality of beans this time that they did last time.
Right. There's a story I love, which is you went to the Philippines for the first time, if I'm not mistaken, in 2008, and there was a chocolate shortage, or there was a cacao shortage. Is that what was happening in 2008?
No. There wasn't a cacao shortage in 2008. There was a time in 2010 when one trader tried to corner the world market, they bought beans out from under me, from a different farmer that I now don't work with.
Yeah.
I only worked with them for a year and a half. I don't know if that's what you're referring to, or my first trip to the Philippines that was 2008.
I was reading this on the website. You go to the Philippines 2008 trying to find another farmer.
Yeah.
And you basically, what it says on the website is that you basically weren't having any luck. And at the end of the trip, all of a sudden you find a farm.
Yes.
So when you go to the Philippines for the first time, do you have meetings set up, or do you basically just touch down and you say, now I got to find the farms?
No.
How do you end up waiting till the very last second to find a farm that is going to work for you?
So I was a criminal defense lawyer for almost 20 years before I started.
This is your origin story.
Yeah. And a lot of times people, they think that trial lawyers or criminal defense lawyers, it's all about the courtroom. It's not. It's about finding people, and it's about asking them questions. It's about turning over stones and planning for those interviews, much like a journalist would. When you don't just walk down the street and think, oh, I'll find Sheryl Crow to interview her for whatever. No, you're going to plan it out. And if you have that meeting set, you're going to work days preparing for that interview. And so what I did is I found a group in the Philippines, and this is the way every origin story is different, but it's someone who knows someone, and I just keep digging, you know. And then what I try to do is I try to get a sample of beans from them that we pay for, you know, half a kilo or a kilo of beans. And then there's an entire checklist that we have to go through, you know. Can I buy from them directly? Can I help them open a bank account to pay them direct? Will the government let me profit share with them? All these things. And then when all of the boxes have been checked and the beans taste good, then I'm going to spend the money to go there. So I did that in the Philippines.
You're doing outreach to these farms before you even get there.
Right.
And how are you, forgive my ignorance, but how are you communicating with them? Through phone calls or through letters or through email, or
it's in the beginning, when I have somebody who knows somebody, I'm communicating through that person or through like an NGO that often is kind of intersected in that path somewhere, and they're helping me as an intermediary communicate. That's how I'm initially communicating with them, and that's what I did in the Philippines. I show up there in 2008. It's a long trip, man.
Yeah.
I mean, one leg of the trip, like Chicago to Hong Kong, is 16 hours. And I get there, and they take me. I land in Davao on the island of Mindanao, and we go to this farm where I thought they had beans ready, you know, to show me that were ready to ship. And I was just completely crestfallen because there wasn't even maybe a fourth of a metric ton. There was nothing, and they were all molded. It was terrible. And I didn't know what I was going to do. I was really just completely at a loss. And so there was this government agency person working with an NGO there called ACDI Voca, and they work in coffee now mainly, but then cocoa. And one of the people that worked for them, a Filipino, said that there was a farmer, and his nickname was Pastor Peter, that he was kind of a teacher, farmer, and preacher. And I said, I want to meet this guy. And I've been with him since 2008.
Using his beans.
Yeah.
So you show up, and then is it basically like, oh, this is going to work?
So in the beginning, I used his beans and beans that he collected from neighbors and other people. And it's been some variation of that ever since. But I knew it was going to work. And the reason is because when he heard the story of me coming all the way over there and that I had planned on buying these beans and spent a lot of money just at that point, he really felt bad. And when you layer on top of that, that there had been no export of cocoa beans from the Philippines since their land reform in like the 80s, it was a matter of national pride for him as a cocoa farmer, an organic cocoa farmer, an experienced farmer, to have the chance to export beans to be made into chocolate. And so I could just tell that he was going to make it happen. And he did, and always has.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did you find early on when you were going into these farms, so you were a lawyer for 20 years, and then, you know, I want to get into it, but then you have this realization of going to chocolate. So now you're tracking down these farms, traveling across the world. When you go to these farms, was it hard for these farmers at first to take you seriously, or did you almost have some kind of imposter syndrome? Am I really going to make chocolate? Here I am promising I'm going to be buying these beans, but am I really going to be able to pull that off and hold these promises? Like, did any of that go through your head, or were the farmers really responsive to you coming in at first, and were they excited to have those relationships?
I would say it was a mixed bag. I didn't really have imposter syndrome then. And I specifically remember in Ecuador, which was my first place that I bought beans, and I'm still buying from this guy, Vitaliano, and he's on the front of the package, and I've been buying from him for 18 years now. And I'll never forget, the first year that I bought beans, he and the other farmers, his neighbors, were very excited. And when I came back to share profits with them the following year, we were sitting around a conference room table sort of place. And I had my consolidated financials in Spanish back then. So from the very first profit share,
you were translating.
I did it when I was in the Philippines. They were in English a few months ago, but in Tanzania, they're in Swahili, and we show the farmers what we make. It's a consolidated version of our financials.
Right.
And one of my contacts in Ecuador, right before that meeting, I said, well, here are my financials I'm going to share with the farm. These are poor farmers. And he was like, you are out of your mind. Don't do that. Don't show them your sales figures. And I was like, well, that's what we're doing. I mean, I practiced open book management as a lawyer. I'm going to do it as a...
But your wife questioned this too. You mentioned that in your book, that your wife thought this was a horrible idea.
Oh yeah. No, she thought it was a bad idea. And she said, even years into it, she was like, I don't know that it really matters to the farmers and that they really care that much about it. But at that first meeting, the farmers are sitting there looking at the financials and they're kind of nodding their heads. And they said to me, so this is how Americans do business, right? And I was like,
not really.
Kind of, you know, I mean, this, I'm an American and we're here and this,
and we're doing business.
And we're doing business. And they had this impression that all Americans share financial information, and it was just, you know, funny for me. But now, of course, I've done it all these years. It's expected. They know what to expect. And the question was answered for me many times over, whether or not the farmers that I work with care about it. Really.
Why do they care about it? They care because it's more money, but it has to be more than that, right?
Yeah, there's so many examples. So one thing, during COVID, I couldn't go, you know, to visit the farms. And I was really concerned in the beginning of COVID about, well, if I don't go, will we still get good beans? You know, even though I've worked with these people for a long time, I just don't take stuff for granted. And we received some of the best beans that we've ever received during any of our years with me not going. And I attributed that in large part to them really caring about delivering quality product to our little company and our family. And I think that was a testament to our relationship. I remember one time I was in this farmer's house in Tanzania that I see every time I'm there. He's an elder in the little cooperative. There's 40 farmers in the co-op. And they were asking me to explain to them what nursing homes were. There was about 5 or 6 farmers in there. They just didn't understand it. I mean, this is rural Tanzania out in the middle of what you would think is nowhere. It's beautiful. And the people who are really old in their community are given a place of stature in meetings. They sit up front. They speak first. And
they're first in line to get chocolate when you bring it, right?
Yes. And anyway, they didn't understand it. I explained it to them. And they said, Mr. Livingston said to me, he said, when it's time for you to go to a nursing home in America, we want you to move here. And we want to take care of you.
Are you going
to
do that?
Well, you know, I have thought about it. My wife is not that, you know, in favor of it.
Yeah.
But I would seriously consider it, if not for my grandchildren that I wouldn't get to see very often.
That would be the thing that's the deal breaker. Yeah, right.
You know, that thing, I just flew in from Austin, and so we're there part-time, and I have a 3.5-year-old granddaughter and now a 5-week-old grandson.
Oh, my God.
And my 3.5-year-old granddaughter has just completely changed my life.
Yeah.
And so I've done a lot of things in my life. I've done a lot. I feel like I've accomplished a lot of things, started a lot of things. But, and it's hard to put it in these terms, but I often think about doing and accomplishing but being with my granddaughter is maybe one of the greatest things I've ever done. And I'm not doing anything. I'm just being. But it's had a huge influence on me in the last 3.5 years. So I don't know if Goldie is her name. If Goldie wanted to go, you know, hang out in Tanzania for a while, maybe I would. But I have thought about it. And, you know, I mean, I think I'd probably have a happier end of my life living there than here.
Cocoa would be great.
It would. And I mean, the food is good.
Is it good when you go over there? What do you end up eating? Local cuisine?
I mean, a lot of rice, a lot of rice, a lot of chicken, and seafood in Tanzania because it's on the shores of Lake Nyasa. And vegetables, and I'm careful about what I eat, but I mean, it's simple food, but prepared with care and all fresh. And you know, that's the thing. They don't have a lot of access to medical care and housing and education, but they have just an amazing amount of joy in community. And I'm not so naive to believe that it's all unicorns and rainbows. I understand, and I've been with them now for 16 years, so I know the wrinkles that happen sometimes in the relationship, but it's a beautiful place. It's changed my life. And I would say, especially in Tanzania, there have been moments where the best way to describe it is to say that the veil is lifted just momentarily to kind of see what I would view as the divine. And then it goes away. But it happens frequently when I'm there.
Yeah. You talk a lot about how your father died of cancer when you were a teenager and how you wanted to go into the family business of law. I think I've heard you say that you almost pictured you would work with him and, you know, you would both be lawyers in a family practice. Mm-hmm. And you didn't get to do that, but now your daughter gets to do that, mm-hmm. running the company with you.
Yeah.
Is that a special relationship, or is it amazing that you were able to, I don't know if you would call this, but that you were able to give her the gift of working with you on this company, which you were never able to do with your father?
Well, thank you for mentioning that. And yeah, I did so want to do that with my dad. You know, I'd go to court with him and go to his office and hang out, and he was my hero. And I did want to do that. And Lauren has worked with me. She co-wrote the book with me. And she's worked with me since she was 16. She's 34 now. And I rely on her for almost every move we make in the company. She's a gifted writer. And she's really the voice of the brand. And so I would say, yes, I've never thought of it in the way that you put it, and I really like the way you put it, because it is a gift. Now, it's not perfect. I don't know if you've ever been in a family business.
I've never been in a family business.
It's not perfect, and she's very independent-minded, very spirited, very willing to share her opinion with me in unfiltered terms. And I like that, but at times it can get a little bit contentious. But at the end of the day, I know that I trust her more than anyone in the business, and she makes great decisions. So I wouldn't trade it. And especially, you know, we had breakfast yesterday morning and she was saying it'll probably be a while before she's able to go back to Tanzania again because of the kids. And she loves to travel with me to Origin, and it's really special when we have the chance to do that.
God, that's so cool. Mm-hmm. I never was even interested in doing what my parents did. They, mm-hmm. It never seemed interesting to me.
Which
at
was
all.
What did they
well,
do?
Well, my mom was a therapist.
That's interesting.
It's incredibly interesting, but I never saw myself as a therapist.
You're kind of a therapist.
Am I? I don't know. Well, I think being around her growing up was, how to connect
that's
with
awesome.
People, I think.
Yeah.
But how open is the open book management that you're pretty well known for? How open is it? And do you ever get uncomfortable with everyone knowing the profits of the company? And I'm assuming it's mostly kept internal. I don't know if people in the company know what your salary is with the company. Where's the line? And does it take a certain amount of confidence to be able to have open book management?
I think, yes, it does have it takes a certain amount of confidence. It takes planning also it takes planning to roll it out if you're an existing company and thinking of doing it. And the great game of business in Springfield, Missouri, my hometown, actually, Jack Stack is kind of the father figure of present and modern open book management. And then Ari Weinzweig, the co-founder of Zingerman's Deli in Ann Arbor, Michigan, who is my mentor, Zingerman's, they teach classes on open book management, as does the great game of business in Springfield. But yeah, it does take confidence. It takes planning, and it takes a certain amount, I would say, even more than confidence, courage, especially to share information when things are not going that great. And over the long term, people begin to understand what the numbers mean, and especially if you're teaching what those numbers mean, And I really think it is a benefit to the company. But I did it, so I've done it for 25 years. I mean, and I did it as a lawyer.
Yeah.
So in my law firm, you know, we everybody knew what the gross revenue numbers were and what the net numbers were. Most people who are practicing open book management, and this is most, not all, they don't share what people's salaries are. But that's not to say that it couldn't be done. We don't do that, haven't done that, probably won't do that.
So for the salary tabs, there are a number, a pocket that just says, and here are all the salaries. And,
right.
it's a round number, basically.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And so, no, I don't see us doing that. But it doesn't really bother me, you know, because I don't, I mean, I'm not, we make a little bit of a profit, not a huge profit. I really haven't had much added to my salary in 18 years, but I make a lot less than I did as a lawyer.
Yeah.
One quick way of looking at it is I now make what I used to pay in taxes. So, you know, that's something you have to get used to. And my wife is a great budgeter and manages our family money and has, you know, put Lauren through college with that money. And she's great at it, but we've made it work. But I don't have any like worry or shame, fear in putting that number out there because, you know, we are doing the best we can with what we have. We don't have, you know, a huge line of credit. We're 20 people in the company. And sure, there are, especially now, I wish I had access to capital to build onto the factory. But we don't have that. I mean, I could get a loan at the bank.
Why wouldn't you? I mean, I want to get into this because I feel like there's a million reasons why that might be against your ethos.
Yeah.
But at the same time, why not get investors or the right investors or take a loan or like why is that not the right move?
Okay. In the beginning, I didn't really want to have investors that I was needing to report to or answer to. I wanted to just be able to do it myself. I mean, I'd already been my own law, you know, I had my own law firm for almost all of those years and I just wanted to kind of do it by myself. But the other thing that sort of underlies that is I didn't really want to focus on growth, top line growth. And that, you know, when you tell an investor, will you please give me your money? And I really don't want to focus on growing the business.
Couldn't you just lie though? Or then you're worried that, you know, it'd be bad down the road when your goals don't align.
Because I mean, just like a couple of months ago, I was in the Philippines and that we started our sixth school lunch program there, not there, but between Tanzania and the Philippines. And, it was a kindergarten class and I had met them the year before when I was there. The February before, and severely malnourished kids. And so we started a program with a donor. First time we used a donor. All the other times we've self-funded those nutrition programs. But I was able to go back and look at the records. Every single one of those kids were no longer, they were considered what the United Nations would define as normal weight and height. And they were all severely malnourished the year before. I mean, that is an example of my focus. And I didn't want to have to tell an investor, well, I probably spent too much time on this fill in the blank community development project or taking, you know, high school students to Tanzania. I didn't want to have to answer to that.
Right.
But now, you know, 18 years later, if I had an opportunity for the right investor
who got the vision, got the project.
There are opportunities that I see in my world of direct trade chocolate that could be real serious opportunities to promote the welfare of the people involved who are, especially the people who are growing and struggling to bring a crop to harvest. Who are really suffering, especially in West Africa. And so, if there was an opportunity to be involved in something like that, I would do it. I feel like I have a lot of gas left in the tank.
Yeah.
I would absolutely do that if I had the right opportunity. Yeah.
What would that look like? Like, would it be getting a loan, or just maybe like an investor who is less concerned about returns and more concerned about, you know, it's not about the chocolate, it's about the chocolate and that mantra.
Yeah. It would be the latter. A bank. I mean, I have a great bank in Springfield. I love my bank. I've been with them for 32 years.
Yeah.
It's a small bank. I mean, they're just great people. I probably could get a loan. Well, but now with rates where they are, it just doesn't make sense.
Right.
It just doesn't make sense. And so I think that it would be some kind of investor who really gets it, who sees the vision, and I am absolutely willing to cede control and whatever else that means, if I can have some role in the vision. Lauren really has a very, very specific vision in mind, and I don't think she's going to take the company over. I had a very specific intention when I started this all those years ago that I didn't want her to take it over because I didn't want her responsible for my retirement. I just didn't want that burden on her.
Yeah.
And so all these years, we've just kind of moved forward with that in mind, that she's not going to take it over. She's perfectly capable of doing it. But I, and at this point now, she's like, yeah, I have gas in the tank left too. I have more than you, Dad. And I have a specific vision. And if there was an investor that came along that really understood what we were trying to do and wanted to take it to the next level, that we could. But here's the thing. There have been tire kickers over the years who've come around, you know.
I'm sure. What kind of investor comes around? It's got to be someone who just loves the quality of the chocolate and just goes, I can't live without this. I want to help this brand.
Yes.
You know, this story's amazing.
Or they want to kind of live my life.
Yeah.
You know? They want to
your chocolate Indiana Jones or Willy Wonka something.
Right.
Yeah.
And we haven't really talked about this, but the way the company started was kind of weird, you know, and there was a very circuitous path to chocolate. I didn't always love chocolate and I didn't have some hidden dream to make chocolate.
It was a 5-year path basically to get
right.
here.
And that did include antidepressants, you know? So, I mean, and there was, surrounding it all, a sort of level of sacredness to it all,
which part? To the process?
All of it. To the process
of finding your vocation, as you say in your book.
Yeah, to the ending of my criminal law practice and the beginning of this thing, I viewed it as a sacred path, and just for me, just my own little sacred path. And so what I've come to realize is that how this ends for me, whatever that means, must also be a sacred path. In order to be in tandem or congruous with the beginning, I think that's important for endings, that they be similarly situated as the beginning.
Yeah. I think your daughter could take it over. I think that would be, because
I would love that.
Who would run this? I don't think any other. I don't think this company could get acquired and still have the care that it has.
She'd have to move to Springfield, Missouri. She lives in Austin, Texas, and I'm telling you, she loves it there.
Yeah.
And you know, we're there a lot, so I get it. But let me just say, if you've ever been to Austin, Texas in July or August,
I was just there.
Oh, well,
It's not July or August, but I was just there last week. Yeah.
It can get really hot.
Yeah,
there.
It gets
which is not good for chocolate making.
That's true.
Yeah.
So what's the thing? Because I always think about, like, with this podcast, for example, or my business, I'm always thinking about, how do I get more listeners? How do I grow revenue? How do I, you know, build the team and do this? And you kind of have this phrase, which is like, you want to get really good at staying small. How can I get better at being smaller or staying smaller? Mm-hmm. And to me, it's like, I feel like if I had that mentality, I would have so much less external stress in my life. I would have a completely different mindset. but I can't get there because to me, it like the, to me, it's about how do I grow my numbers? How do I do this? Where am I having this disconnect, or how can I change my mindset on this?
I think that one that we all have to recognize when considering that question, that it's aspirational, you know, and it's a moving target. And one of the chapters in my book is called How Much is Enough? And Seth actually coined this phrase, more is not enough.
Yeah.
And I mean, he probably didn't originate that, but he certainly highlighted it for me. And so if we can take those parts of our lives and say and ask that question, just even asking the question, even if we can't come up with the answer, how much is enough? I mean, how many Instagram followers do you need?
Yeah.
Then if we're just asking the question, then our hearts and minds will kind of be focused on the question and the answer will change over time. That's how we get there, I think. Because how much is enough for me right now is different than how much was enough for me when I was 44, you know? And so that's how I do it. And I don't beat myself up because the number or the thing changes, you know, how much is enough? What is sufficient? We are so pressured by our North American culture on growth that we are, you know, investors want us to grow. The Chamber of Commerce wants us to grow. Our friends and family want us to grow because it means success. And so one way to do it is asking the question that I said. Another way is to consider growth in non-traditional ways. Like I just mentioned, we started our sixth school lunch program.
How many lunches? I know the number, but how many lunches have you served?
I mean, it's over a million. We stopped counting. Yeah, yeah. We stopped counting at that. And this is with 20 people.
Yeah.
And we started a foundation 5 years ago. So this, what was a project, which was called Chocolate University, you know, to engage the kids of our neighborhood and all that stuff. And then to have this community development work in Tanzania and the Philippines. It was just a project. And we ultimately needed to put it into a 501c3 nonprofit because people were donating money to help us do these things. We opened a preschool that we built in Tanzania in January of 2020. I didn't pay for that. A donor in Washington, D.C., a husband and wife, just amazing people, wrote us a check for a preschool. $85,000 built a preschool in Tanzania.
Yeah.
That wouldn't get you a few parking spaces in the United States.
Right.
But, okay, so that has one part-time employee. Missy Gellner has worked for us for all the years that we've had this nonprofit. And that's it. She works 15 hours a week, and we do all this stuff with these people. And so we're looking at those numbers a lot. How many kids are in the Empower Girls and Enlighten Boys programs? How can we expand that given our limited resources? How can I raise more money to pay for more kids to go to Tanzania for free for them and me shoulder the burden of raising the money for them to go to Tanzania, American high schools. So if I'm focused on that and there's only so many hours in the day, that's what I'm stressing about. I'm stressing about, you know, can I raise money for the feminine hygiene program that we have for girls in Tanzania? You know, that's a big number to pay for every year for these girls. You know, it's $25,000 a year. And if I'm stressing about that, then I'm spending less time on the other stuff.
Right.
And so that kind of goes back to that phrase that you use, that we use, that it's, you know, it's not about the chocolate, it's about the chocolate. And that mindset helps. And the third thing I would say, these are all helps too, by the way, they're not fixes. Is now I lost my train of thought.
You were talking about the stressing about girls that.
Okay, great. All right, the third thing is if you can develop a practice an almost daily discipline or weekly discipline that is reminding you of why you started this business in the first place, why you became a journalist and a podcaster and, you know, doing this that we're doing now, then that practice will help tether you to that original reason of why you're doing it to begin with. And what happens in for all of us is we start this thing, we want it to grow, and we pour all of our efforts and energy into growing the thing, and maybe it does grow. But over time, we lose connection with why we started it and what fills us up. And some kinds of practices that we intentionally deploy can really remind us. And that's something I try to do.
What are the ones that you do for your company or the work that you're doing now?
The best one that I can think of is that I'm still very involved in selecting the students in Southwest Missouri that travel with us to Tanzania who were selected to be part of that program. And I'm very much a part of leading that program with others to take the young people to Tanzania to have this transformative experience that we've done since 2009. And it's a lot of effort, but it is something that, so because of the way everything is structured, I have to do it. And when I do it, it totally reminds me of why I started this thing to begin with. And I could delegate that to somebody else.
Yeah.
Easily.
Right.
A lot of people would love to, you know, go to Tanzania and have this experience, but I don't delegate it. And I by not delegating it, I'm certain that I'm sacrificing other opportunities. I mean, you know, I'd have more time to meet with, you know, the head person at Whole Foods on, you know, can they put us into more locations?
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
But I don't have that time.
Yeah.
And so.
So when you talk about, because you have this phrase, which is, that I mentioned earlier, which is like, how do we get better at staying small? Do you segment that into different parts of your business? So maybe one part is how do we get better at being small, but then the part where you're helping kids get lunch, maybe you have a different mentality, which is how do we make that explosive and as big as possible? Or is it all kind of in that mantra?
It's all kind of in that mantra. And believe me, there is a great temptation among people who are doing community development work. And then when I say community development, it can be in your neighborhood or halfway around the world like Tanzania or the Philippines. And this temptation is to keep expanding the program and to keep doing more and raising more money and doing
this. I have this problem in my own business, and I can't, and I, maybe I'm doing the right thing and I should just focus on it, but I'm always thinking, maybe I should do this, maybe I should do this, maybe I should do that.
Well, what I'm speaking of specifically though, the trick or the temptation and where it is, it's such a great temptation when the need is great.
Yeah.
So when you see children who need food and need to have access to education and after school programs and greater medical care, you can suffer from this need to do something about it such that it will destroy the core of what gives you the opportunity to do it in the first place. This is a common theme among people who work in like NGOs and nonprofits, but we're not a nonprofit. I mean, we're a for-profit business. And so I have to be very, very careful about it and sort of keep these plates spinning at the same time of, yes, we need to expand our Empower Girls and Enlighten Boys program. We literally talked about it this week. Do we have the budget to add a new school in Tanzania? I mean, this summer we will have graduated 10,000 young people through that program since we started it
Wow.
in 2011. This is all in around this rural village in Tanzania where we buy cocoa beans. And So I am continually, you know, putting the brakes on things, even though there's this great temptation to help, because I just have to be careful about the balance of it all. And I have to be careful that the work of the nonprofit doesn't just completely overtake the for-profit business. And it very easily could. I mean, really, the need and the demand is higher right now in the nonprofit, the Chocolate University work that we do and the foundation work that we do than the private business. I mean, if I had the resources and funding, that would explode, you know. But and it's also one of those things, too, that we just it's all in balance. It's all and it's all in many ways not, and I say this, I want to say this in a way that isn't trite or cliche or, and that is, it's kind of for me.
The work that you do,
the
for
work
others.
That we do, and for, it's yeah. yes, selfishly, it's yeah. for me. And, and if I can focus on that and maintain that aspirationally, then part of that will end up being the case, you know, and I will experience the, you know, transformative effect of that.
Yeah.
And if I can give the opportunity to others to kind of do that for themselves, like these students that I mentioned, which has actually been the case, then great. But this is the work, you know, and we haven't talked about it, but 24 years ago, I co-founded a grief center called Lost and Found in Springfield, Missouri. Still very active. We've served 20,000 people since we started who've experienced the death of a parent or sibling in 22 counties in Southwest Missouri. And I'm involved in the teen group now. I'm on the board, but I'm in a teen group. And I've done that for 13 years. And we meet twice a month, and these are kids whose parents have died, or a brother or sister. And those evenings when we're in group are I leave those meetings filled with a kind of joy that's really hard to describe, and it is, that work is my true self, as Thomas Merton would say. And if I can have more of that and less of the other, it's fine. That's why I would go back to whatever happens in my business, and don't tell my wife that I say this because she will not, but it's the ending of it, however that is, or whatever happens in business, it's going to be fine. It's going to be okay.
Yeah.
It almost can't not be okay.
Yeah.
It's
right.
going to be okay.
Yeah.
And, and yes, I do some things to sort of hedge that, like keep my law license active. You know, I do my CLE every year and pay the Missouri bar. But right now, for example, literally right now, the chocolate industry is experiencing the greatest upheaval that it has in the last 40 years.
Yeah.
Because the price of cocoa has skyrocketed in the last 18 months. And it's upending everybody from the largest chocolate makers in the world to little people, you know, in the chocolate industry like me. And it's very, very topsy-turvy. And I don't know what's going to happen, but it's going to be okay. It'll be okay. And so right now I'm focused on with everything that's happening with the price of cocoa beans. I'm focused on the farmer relationships that we have and what can we do to make sure that they get through this okay. and that we get through it okay too.
Right.
Together. And so I'm not fatalistic about it. I'm just confident that it's going to be okay.
Yeah.
That's because, so if I can spend my life rocking Cardinal in his nursery, you know, this 5-week-old grandson that I have, and if I can spend time, you know, at the playground with Goldie or at the Thinkery in Austin or wherever.
That's enough.
Yeah, it's enough. Yeah. It's enough. If I can work with these teens, if I can take some high school students to Tanzania, I mean, this is it.
Yeah.
That's it. That's all there really is.
Do you have, I feel like the product list is actually not that large. It's a selection of bars. There's the, you have these s'mores bites, you have the you have malt balls, and you have a couple of cacao options.
It's whiskey soaked nibs.
Whiskey soaked nibs.
Yeah.
Is that intentional to keep the product list? Maybe that is a big product list, but it feels like it's a pretty simple product list. There's a variety of bars and a handful of other things. Is that intentional so that you don't get distracted with too many products that then might take away from some of the other things?
I'm going to replay this for our chief operating officer. He would... We think it doesn't feel like a simple
I can imagine that list, probably, you know, yeah, it probably is easy for me to say, but probably is all very complicated.
Well, it's we have a, you know, we manage inventory in a kind of rudimentary way, but we meet every week about inventory and why are we out of stock of this thing,
yeah,
and when is it going to be back in stock? And of course, to some extent, okay, it's all right to run out of something because that means people like it,
right?
And okay. But it's not okay to do it when you have 400 stores around the country and coffee shops
that are relying on it. Yeah.
You know, like we were just talking, Pinewood Social buys our chocolate for their mochas and hot cocoa. And I want them to be able to have mochas, you know. And
right.
So I don't want to leave them stranded. So we need to. So we're very, very careful about inventory management and control. And coming out with new products takes a pretty long time. Lauren is in charge of that. And that's, you know, honestly, it's also part of the fun of it. And we're getting ready to go through a process where we're going to discontinue some bars. And we haven't done that in a while, but we're getting ready to do it. And that'll be kind of fun too, because it's a good, healthy discussion.
Yeah. The peanut butter bar is my favorite. Don't discontinue
we're
that.
We're going to discontinue
okay,
that.
Great.
That's not on the list.
A couple really rapid fire questions because we're running out of time.
Sure.
So first of all, last year I felt like there were a couple of articles in early of 2023 about dark chocolate containing lead. Is that something that you've come across or has been a concern with you? I'm sure you're doing it, you know, you have the best beans in the world, but I'm just curious how that plays into the chocolate industry.
There is litigation going on in California right now with something that California has called Prop 65. So everyone who does any business in California, from Starbucks to Disney World to us or anyone, Target, if you sell anything in California, then you have to comply with Prop 65. Prop 65 covers, among many things, heavy metals. And so there was this discussion of lead and cadmium in chocolate.
Yeah.
And so it's a kind of complicated issue, but there was a sort of temporary settlement. These big chocolate makers were involved with activists in California who basically are law firms that sue and get attorney's fees. But the bottom line is that all of our chocolate meets or exceeds those thresholds of this California Prop 65 law. And so I'm not worried about it. We do get questions about it. And I would say that what we try to encourage people to do, and we talk about this on our website, is put it all in context, because avocados are going to have more cadmium than a serving of chocolate.
Yeah.
And spinach and these things. So it's all a matter of context. The other thing I try to say for people who are really, really focused on this is, hey, okay, be focused on this, but would you mind focusing on this other thing that I think has a greater impact on your health? And that is that there are 1.58 million children in West Africa who are harvesting the cocoa beans that went into your chocolate bar that you bought at the convenience store cash register for $2.
Yeah.
And 70% of those kids are involved in what's called the worst forms of child labor. So think 8-year-old carrying a machete, 10-year-old with a fertilizer backpack. That is much more harmful to your health than what is presently in what we're finding in.
Yeah. This is great news because I'm still eating dark chocolate. So this is great news.
Yes.
Really quickly, too, in your book, you talk about a certain rice that you were selling on your store, and now you're not. It seems like you're not selling anymore. Does this rice still exist? What is this rice?
It exists, but not on our website. Yeah. And you have to go to southwestern Tanzania to get it.
It's the only way to get it.
Kiela.
Gosh darn.
Yeah, I'll get it in about 4 weeks. We used it in the beginning to fund the nutrition program.
That's right.
Yeah, and so now that. And this is what we do when we start these programs. We enter a plan of sustainability with the school or whatever. Like, this is the end date, folks. You need to be doing this on your own by this date. And that's what they did. And then they are. They're feeding their kids at that high school on their own now without our help. So we don't need to sell the rice to do it. Although, you know, I have thought about bringing it back just because it's amazing rice, just to bring it back and sell it.
I'm dying to try this rice. You say it's the best rice you've ever had. It's naturally sweet.
Yeah. Yes, it is.
Okay, amazing.
Well, here's how great it is.
Yeah, yeah.
It's sold in the black market in Tanzania.
Oh, my God.
In Tanzania.
Oh, my God.
People mislabel it. They put Kiela rice on rice.
Yeah.
Kiela rice just because it's that famous.
Okay, I'm running through these here. If we can answer this quickly, what is white chocolate? You have you have these white chocolate bars on your website. Yeah. What do you say about them? They're like the only direct-to-bean white chocolate bars in existence?
We were the first people to make cocoa butter from scratch in North America in small batches. And so it's cocoa butter, goat's milk, and sugar. That's white chocolate.
And the goat's milk is what makes it white.
No. Well, what makes it white is the FDA standard of identity says it has to be over a certain percent of cocoa butter and a dairy. And so we just pick goat's milk. I like goat's milk because it has a kind of caramel note to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, interesting. Last thing, you say in your book that one of your best skills as a lawyer was cross-examining crooked cops. Is that what you say?
Mm-hmm.
How do you do that? What's the secret? Or what's the strategy?
People ask me often, you know, if I miss the courtroom, and I'm not really. I occasionally do miss cross-examining lying police officers. There's nothing quite like it. Because when you're defending someone, especially someone that you really believe in, and the full force, power, and money of the government is behind the prosecution, you know, the state, it's satisfying to be able to just be one person and stand in the pathway of someone who's trying to topple over your client unjustly. And I'm not saying that all police officers, all law enforcement are like this, but there are law enforcement officers out there who make stuff up and who lie. And most of the time, I find this out by investigation and by not giving up and working and working and working and working, reading and just outworking the other side. And the way that it happens in cross-examination is it's a very patient style of questioning that is not time limited. And the idea in cross-examination, the gold star answer is yes. Yes, 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 yes. Anything other than that in cross-examination is not perfect. And so what I was going for in cross-examination of any witness, but in particular experts and law enforcement officers, is yes, yes, yes.
So you phrase your questions to get a yes answer.
You phrase your question to get a yes answer, and you know the answer before. And I was always prepared to have the supporting documentation at hand when the officer disputed the yes question and said no or tried to qualify it, to the point that there were times I was kind of known for my notebooks in court. And I had so many notebooks. In one particular murder case, I had to rent a U-Haul to bring the notebooks to court. And I remember there were instances where witnesses would kind of flinch when the binder would open because they knew I was getting ready to, it's called impeachment of a witness, when I was getting ready to impeach them with a document that said, okay, you're lying, you made this up, stop lying. But let me just say that I want to say this. When you're doing that as a lawyer, you better have your eye over here on the jury, because don't take it too far. If you're right and you prove this person is not being truthful, you should always ask one question less than what the jury would expect. So I want the jury, I want to leave the jury with wanting me to ask more. Or,
oh, that's so interesting.
Because I don't want to do it for them. I want them to say, oh man, Sean, why didn't you ask him that one more last question? That he's not being honest, yeah. You know, he or she is not being honest. And so I had one eye on the jury because I wanted them to not think that I was taking it too far, that I was rubbing it in or twisting the sword. I wanted them to do it. I wanted them to do it when they got back to the jury room deciding the verdict.
Right. And you never lost a jury case.
No.
In your entire career. So this man knows what he's talking about. 20 years as a lawyer, loved it until he hated it. Spent 5 years trying to find a new vocation. Ended up making chocolate, which he's doing today. It's the greatest story ever. I love it. I love the product. AskAnozyChocolate.com. Check it out. Buy the products. You can order them. They come with a handwritten note. They ship fast. There's a recipe for chocolate cake that comes on the back of the handwritten note. Great marketing tip, because I looked at that and I was like, now I want to buy the cocoa powder so I can make this cake. Absolutely brilliant. The chocolate's some of the best. Were you ever worried about the name? Did you think AskAnozy would be a tough name for a chocolate company, or was it just natural?
And I did worry about it a little bit. But my grandfather was Ashkenazi. He was a Ukrainian Jew refugee. Yeah. And when he got to New York, they changed it to AskAnozy. So here we are.
Wow. Amazing. You have to go get this chocolate if you're listening. You will not regret it. Some of the best chocolate around. The story is amazing. And we only touched the surface. We probably could talk for another hour. But you've given TED Talks and you've done a ton of podcasts. And people can go find the rest of your story there. Or read the book, which I highly recommend. Which I read this week, and it was a great read, and so many adventures there, and we didn't even cover half of it. So, Sean, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. We'll see you next time.
All right.